From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The Supreme Court says Americans have a right to own and keep a loaded handgun at home for self-defense and hunting. In a historic 5-4 decision last week, the High Court overturned the 32-year-old ban on handguns in the nation's capital. President Bush welcomed the ruling, as did John McCain. Barack Obama said he supported an individual's right to bear arms, but said the right was not absolute. But some lawmakers were more critical. In a moment, we'll hear from Democratic Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, who represents the District of Columbia. After the ruling, she made a statement saying that the ruling could produce, quote, an increase in accidents and gun violence. But first, we're joined by Bob Levy. He's a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute and co-counsel for Richard Heller. Heller is the plaintiff who challenged the more than 30-year-old ban on handguns in Washington, D.C., and won. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Nice to be with you.
So what was your interest in litigating this case, and what was your role in pulling people together on this case?
Two attorneys from the Institute for Justice approached me back in 2002 and suggested that the time might be ripe for a Second Amendment challenge. I added some legal expertise and a few dollars to the effort, and we went forward and signed up six plaintiffs and another attorney and pressed forward with the suit, which took 5.5 years to litigate. My interest was plainly to vindicate the meaning of the Second Amendment and the right secured by the Second Amendment. And in that effort, we have succeeded, I'm happy to say.
The Second Amendment says, in part, a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But, you know, America during the Revolution is not America today. There's different kinds of guns that can cut people in half, literally. Have you ever thought that what you were litigating for is not what the founders intended?
Well, as you mentioned, Barack Obama has said the Second Amendment is not absolute. I don't know anyone who believes that the Second Amendment is absolute. After all, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law about free speech, but we have rules against shouting fire in a crowded theater and incitement to riot and obscenity and defamation and extortion and a whole line of cases that have upheld restrictions on free speech. In the same sense, there are obviously some things that can be regulated. We did not deny that. You can keep weapons away from crazy people, from kids. You can keep weapons away from violent felons. You can keep some classes of weapons away from everybody. You can keep weapons out of highly sensitive areas like elementary schools, for example. So this is, I think, a straw man that the anti-gun folks have raised. Responsible people, and I would count myself among them, do not argue for an absolutist view of the Second Amendment.
What do you think of studies, including a long-term study done in D.C. and Baltimore, that suggests that bans don't actually do anything to stop homicides and suicides tied to handguns? Is this decision tied to that kind of a regulation or a scientific foundation?
There's been a great deal of literature on the effect of handgun bans and other gun regulations, and I think it's quite clear to say that the weight of the data suggests that these handgun bans have not been effective. The most encompassing studies have been by two federal government agencies. Back in 2004, the National Academy of Sciences reviewed 253 journal articles and 99 books and 43 government publications and evaluated 80 gun control measures, and they couldn't identify a single gun control regulation that reduced violent crime or suicide or accidents. And the Centers for Disease Control found the same thing. So while there is evidence on both sides, I think the weight of the evidence suggests that these gun laws do not work. Washington, D.C. is certainly a case in point. But I want to emphasize that our lawsuit was about the meaning of the Constitution. It was not solely about weighing scientific evidence and getting expert witnesses to testify about the effectiveness of gun laws. If gun laws are effective, and I doubt that they are, but if they are, and yet the Second Amendment says we can have a gun for self-defense, if it's necessary to revise that, the answer is go repeal the Second Amendment. Go adopt a different rule. Don't act as though the Constitution didn't exist and that it was made out of tissue paper.
What about common sense? There was the case recently where a gentleman was facing a potential robbery home invasion. He shot two people. And law enforcement officers said, don't shoot them. Just go in your house. Does this give carte blanche to people who have guns to go out and just shoot? Maybe they feel threatened, but maybe it's not the best thing to do.
It doesn't give carte blanche to anybody in two respects. First of all, the lawsuit is not about carrying guns outside the home. This is about possessing an ordinary garden variety firearm for self-defense within the home. So with respect to going out on the streets of the nation's capital and shooting people, this lawsuit has nothing to say about that. If that's going to be litigated, it'll have to be litigated later. The second issue is that the laws about self-defense remain on the books. You cannot, just because you have a right to a firearm in your home, willy-nilly shoot anybody that you feel like it within the context of the privacy of your own residence. There are still laws that say when you can shoot in self-defense and when you cannot. Those laws have not been changed.
Do you foresee a ripple effect when, for example, Ward Connerly started challenging affirmative action, you know, starting with the UC, the University of California system? There was then a domino effect. Just quickly, do you see there being a series of other litigations that follow on this?
I hope so. There are 44 states, however, that already recognize an individual right. There are 48 states that have concealed carry with varying degrees of police discretion. So the real issue is cities like Washington, D.C., that are operating, other cities operating under delegated state power that have handgun bans like D.C.'s, and that would be Chicago and San Francisco and Toledo and, to a lesser extent, New York. They're going to be challenged, and I hope they are overturned, as has been D.C.'s.
Well, Bob, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Now, for a different perspective, we turn to Democratic Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, who represents the District of Columbia. She's been speaking out about this decision, and she joins us now from the nation's capital. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So now that the rulings come down, what do you think is going to change for your district and for the Washington metro area?
Well, two things are going to happen. There are going to be tight regulations under a tightly written law. And no matter what we do, you're going to see violence in the home, particularly that we didn't see before, domestic violence, suicides, because people will be able to keep guns in their homes. And all the data tells us that while guns are rarely used to catch a criminal, they are often used to attack family members during quarrels or friends during quarrels, and of course, accidents and suicides. We are very concerned that these guns have no lock and key on them, of course, and there's no ball and chain, so they will make their way into the streets in some cases. We're going to do the best we can to control what happens, but the fact is that the court has spoken. The conservatives who decried the court when it was not on their side, I suppose, love the court now, so I think they should stop talking about activist courts, because we've just seen an activist court at work.
Now, you suggested the wording of the decision left open the possibility for new and differently worded gun bans, including in the district. What do you mean, what do you see ahead?
All the decision requires is that a person be permitted to have a gun in her home to be used only for self-defense purposes. You can write a dozen regulations around that, and I'm sure the district is in the process of doing it. In fact, the bill has already been introduced. You've got to understand that 100% of the council and the mayor oppose this, and that's the way it's been throughout the history of the district ever since we got home rule.
When you think about the District of Columbia, I mean, you are a non-voting member of Congress who has a huge amount of public influence through what you do, but you don't have the same rights as other people who are in Congress. And when you think about your district, the people in it, the racial composition, the economic composition, what do you want to see for your people?
Well, it's a travesty that in the 21st century there would be any American citizens that didn't have representation in their own Congress. I do vote in the Committee of the Whole. I vote in committee. I'm chair of a subcommittee. But the fact is, on the final vote, whether to go to war or not, whether to raise your taxes or not, my folks don't get a final vote on that through me or anybody else because they don't have representation in the Congress. And yet, of course, the Congress can do what it wants at will to us as it does to others. We're trying to get the House vote now. We got it through the House. We expect another vote in the Senate soon. To the credit of 8 Republicans who joined the senators, there were 57% of the Senate for giving the district. This is the House-only vote, the House-only vote. But as your listeners may know, only in the Senate of the United States, nowhere else in the world, is 51% not a majority. So here you had, in the 21st century, the filibuster of a voting rights bill. There have been a lot of people on the ground in targeted states, so I think we can still win this one meager vote for the 600,000 people who live in the District of Columbia this year. If not, we think there's going to be a change in the White House, and that should do it.
Well, Congresswoman, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's Democratic Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, who represents the District of Columbia. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Jazz. Some of us know it when we hear it, some love it, some don't. Jazz is one of the foundations of black music and American music. This month on News and Notes, we're going to focus in on an art form that's traveled the world and changed it. Today, we're taking a crash course in jazz, Jazz 101, with jazz educator, historian, and producer Bill Kirshner. Bill is also a composer, arranger, and saxophonist and formed the Bill Kirshner Nonette over 20 years ago. Also, we've got David Schroeder. He directs jazz studies at New York University's Steinhardt School, and he plays reed with his own group, Combo Nuevo. Also, we have Eugene Holly Jr., a Delaware-based freelance jazz writer and producer. His work has appeared in Downbeat, Philadelphia Weekly, Vibe, and most recently, The Village Voice. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Hello.
So, you know, this is a big topic, and I'm not incredibly well-versed, so... Eugene, tell me about the origins of jazz. We see it as one of the first African-American forms of music, often tie it to New Orleans. Where did the sound really originate?
Well, it originated in the American South, in the New Orleans region. And New Orleans is important for the origin because in the 19th and early 20th centuries, you had a mix of not only free and slave people of African descent. You had people from Cuba, people from Haiti, from all over the Caribbean. You also had an old European population. Some of the first opera in this country was formed in New Orleans, so you had a great mix in the New Orleans area that birthed jazz. And the one reason why jazz is so popular around the world and why it's so vital, it's our most mixed and our most multicultural art form, and it really mirrors what the diversity of this country has to offer.
David, what do you think of this idea of jazz being inherently multicultural?
Well, I agree, especially if we talk about New Orleans as a melting pot for jazz. It was filled with all the Caribbean countries, all the ex-slave and slavery folks, as well as Europeans like Sicilians. We forget there was a lot of Italians and Germans and a wide variety of cultures living in New Orleans. After the Louisiana Purchase, New Orleans was a major seaport where everybody came to do their trade and to move into the United States.
Bill, one of the things about music is that for most people, it's indescribable. It's something you get or something you don't. And something that you don't describe. Now, if you're a critic or a historian or a musician, that's different. So if you had someone who didn't really have language for jazz, how would you try to tell them about it?
It's like any other kind of music. Don't forget, for the first half of jazz's existence, for about the first 50 years, it was primarily dance music. And also, someone once asked Count Basie to define his music, and Basie's response was three words, pat your foot. So I guess what I'm leading up to is, you know, we tend to over-intellectualize jazz. The fact is that there are all different kinds of jazz, some that are more accessible and approachable than others, but the most accessible of those are perfectly approachable and understandable to anybody with open ears and a foot that they can tap.
So, Bill, if you were talking to someone who has who loves music but doesn't really know much about jazz, who would you recommend they listen to?
Do you have about 3 days?
No, cut it down to 60 to 75 seconds.
Well, you start with the obvious heavyweights. You start with Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and then we can go to about 1,000 more. You know, jazz has a rich heritage of now fully 100 years, and since 1917 it's been recorded. So there's a rich recorded heritage, and luckily for the past 20 or so years, a lot of that has been made available on CD that previously was out of print or otherwise unavailable for decades. And now with downloading, of course, being another possibility, jazz is easily accessible to anybody who wants to listen to it.
All right, let me play a little bit of Louis Armstrong, a fabulous pioneer, and of course, part of New Orleans.
Now, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. Boy, I brought you into my home, you wouldn't leave my wife alone. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. Boy, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you.
Eugene, on one level, this is it's a little bit of a bitter song, but upbeat. And when you hear this, what do you hear?
What I'm hearing is the Prometheus of American music. Louis Armstrong is really the first instrumentalist who really put jazz on the map. There were people before him, but Louis Armstrong really embodied what we consider jazz in the world. And you're playing that particular cut. Louis Armstrong also is the progenitor of jazz singing. Every person who aspires to sing jazz is really singing Louis Armstrong. He was also the first person to start scatting, you know. He did that on a record called Heebie-Jeebies in 1927. But when I hear that, what I hear in Louis Armstrong is his ability to take a tune like that that has a bit of quality and just transcend that with such human optimism. That tragic optimism that Ralph Murray and Ralph Ellison talk about, that's at the core of Louis Armstrong's music and his art.
All right, David, I want to play you someone else, one of the women instrumentalists, not always as many as you might think in jazz, Mary Lou Williams. Have not always made as strong a mark in instrumentalism as in vocals. So who is Mary Lou Williams and what does she represent?
Well, Mary Lou Williams in the 1930s was way at the forefront of women in jazz and many jazz musicians. She was really known as a teacher for a lot of the musicians in the Kansas City region. And I mean, you can tell she's well studied. And she is, I think, probably has prepared herself by listening to all the great stride pianists before her. And, you know, she had quite a long career. But quite definitely, she really stands out as a singular in women for that time period.
Dave, I want to actually play a little bit of your work, your group Combo Nuevo. This is called Go Figure. Thank you. How would you describe this music, and what are you playing in the combo?
Well, in that group, I'm playing, on this track, I'm playing electric alto clarinet, believe it or not. But the group is an odd group. We've decided that music continues, jazz music continues to grow and morph and be involved with many types of cultures. This ensemble, instead of a drum set, it's Middle Eastern frame drums and Indian tablas, and instead of a bassist, it's a cello, and it's acoustic guitar and penny whistles and chromatic harmonicas and such. And, you know, I think this follows true with the jazz tradition of, I really don't believe that jazz music is something of a museum piece, but something that continues to grow and flourish and be invigorated by other forms of music.
You mentioned a lot of international music, so I guess in general, I mean, it makes sense that musicians would seek out different influences, but do you think that the U.S. music market itself, in terms of how most people think of these genres that they listen to, is expanding, or do people kind of go in their own tracks, and people who like pop music listen to pop, and people who like hip-hop just listen to hip-hop?
Well, it's true that people become very stuck into the music that they've run across and they've fallen in love with. I think the problem with jazz is it's not easily available in on radio or on television. You might find it in a film score here or there, but you know what? When we have kids listen to music, they don't find new forms of music easily. They find common denominator music, which is fine, all the pop songs, etc., MTV. But for jazz musicians specifically, it's hard to find a place in the market for our music and find, I think if people had a chance to listen to it, it'd be a new ballpark.
Eugene, when I listen to contemporary popular music that comes from black artists, I was just yesterday listening to KCRW, which is one of the NPR member stations. They were playing some remixes that mixed hip-hop and Indian music, tablas, etc. You'll find hip-hop with electronica, etc., etc., etc. Jazz, not so much. I mean, do you think that jazz is still a part of popular music, or is it a kind of a subgenre?
Oh, no question. It's part of popular music. Jazz has always given popular music a boost for the last 50 years. And you mentioned hip-hop. You know, when hip-hop really was in vogue, like in the 90s, I mean, one of my favorite groups, A Tribe Called Quest, they made a career out of sampling people like Joe Zawinul and Weather Report. I was listening to a great producer, Jay Dilla, just left us a short time ago. And one of his greatest productions was De La Soul's Stakes is High, which contains a sample of Ahmad Jamal's Swahili Land. And throughout hip-hop and throughout popular music, you hear jazz diffused in a whole bunch of things that you might not really think is jazz, but when you do some research, you say, oh, I've heard this before. So it's definitely in hip-hop. You hear a lot of jazz in commercials. One of my favorite commercials out right now is a Volkswagen commercial with a female drummer named Cindy Blackman, who used to drum for Lenny Kravitz. She's in the commercial. So people are hearing jazz in the popular idiom, but it's not always stated explicitly.
All right, Bill, you have been playing, arranging, and composing music for years. We want to play a little bit of your music as well. This is Pretty Blue. All right, Bill, I'm going to go out on a short limb here and say that your jazz music sounds like jazz, what I was told jazz was. Well, is that mean it's traditional? What kind of music are you playing?
I'm playing my music.
Okay.
I have to say also in my own defense that I'm a determined eclectic, so that's one of the most traditional things on that particular record that you could have picked. Some of the other things are much less traditional. Some of them have avant-garde influences. Some of them have Brazilian influences. I'm determined not to be put in any particular pigeonhole, and that's how I present myself as a musician. So in the course of an evening concert, for example, my presentation could run the gamut of influences from something that's relatively straight ahead to something that's determinately not.
I'm going to kind of get ready to close us out with a question, which is, you know, for many of us, we have a favorite genre or two, whether it's hip-hop, rock, pop, soul, you know, 70s, 80s, whatever you want to define a genre as. If you are not someone who already has plugged into jazz, why would you, Eugene?
For the sheer diversity of the art, because in the 100 years jazz has been in existence, and particularly in the last 40 years, there's so much diversity of particularly the jazz music of the 1960s. For example, you opened up with a great John Coltrane classic, Giant Steps, which was recorded in 1959. And from 1959 to 1979, there was a whole bunch of innovation and experimentation going on. You had Herbie Hancock coming into his own. You had Bill Evans. You had Miles Davis, Wayne Shorter. And also you had a lot of Latin jazz really happening in the 60s with people like Eddie Palmieri, Tito Puente, and so on. So you listen to jazz, you can cue into it through its diversity. And once you start getting a handle on how wide the music is, you can just take it from there.
All right, we're going to have to keep this really tight. Bill and then David, why? Why jazz? Why should we listen if we're not already fans? Bill.
Simply because it's fun to listen to. I think the worst thing we can do is present jazz as a form of musical spinach. You listen to it, it's good for you. It's simply great music that's fun to listen to, and anybody who's motivated to find music of whatever description that's fun to listen to should seek it out.
David?
Well, I think, too, that if we compare this to people who are interested in wine, you know, there's people who are connoisseurs of fine wine, and people who drink wine out of a screw top bottle. But jazz, the musicians themselves are brilliant. And as you get more into jazz, you realize, my gosh, how does that guy play this way? When we listen to Louis Armstrong, where did he come up with that? And it continues and it spirals and it grabs you. And once you realize that all the skills and the years and the polish and the practicing and how it comes down into just making beautiful music, that's the fun bag at the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Well, gentlemen, it's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
David Schroeder is the director of jazz studies at New York University's Steinhardt School and a member of the jazz group Combo Nuevo. He spoke with us from NPR's New York studios. Bill Kirshner is a jazz educator, historian, musician, and composer. And Eugene Holly Jr. is a freelance jazz reviewer and columnist. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It seems that wherever the Olympics go, politics follow. And the 1960 Summer Olympics in Rome brought all sorts of culture clashes to the fore. Journalist David Marinus has written the book Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. David, welcome.
Thanks, Farai. Great to be with you.
So, this was the first nationally televised Olympics, and several African countries were fighting for independence, but no black African had won a gold medal thus far in the Olympics. That was about to change dramatically. So tell us about who changed that.
Who changed that was Bibi Bakila, a marathoner from Ethiopia. You're right, there had been no black African gold medalist before him. The summer of 1960 was a summer of enormous transformation in Africa. 14 nations got their independence that summer, throwing off the yoke of colonialism. And Abibi Bakila from Ethiopia sort of was the first of the great African runners. He came to Rome not liking the shoes he had with him, so he actually threw them away and ran barefoot through the streets of Rome, winning the marathon in the capital city of the country that invaded his homeland 25 years earlier. Italy had conquered Ethiopia in 1935 and 36. So it was both a great athletic achievement, a sort of a miracle running barefoot, and an important historical and sociological effort when he was the first black African to win.
And from here in America, we had Wilma Rudolph. And you start with the great story about how she was a teen mom and a bit ostracized, more so than she would have been otherwise. Who was she when she was part of the Clarksville, Tennessee squad, the Tiger Bells?
Wilma Rudolph came from a family of 22 kids. She had suffered from scarlet fever and polio as a child. She had to wear a brace on her leg for several years when she was pre-adolescent. She had been part of the 1956 squad that won the bronze medal in Melbourne, Australia, then came home to Clarksville, still a high school kid, and got pregnant, had a baby before she turned 18, and then joined the Tiger Bells of Nashville, Tennessee, actually, the Tennessee State historically black school there. And they went to Rome as a team. She won 3 gold medals, swept the 100-meter dash, the 200-meter dash, and she and her teammates, the Tiger Bells, won the relay race and really captured the imagination of the world, because these were the first televised Olympics. She had such an elan about her and a very strong figure as well. One thing she did that was of importance and took a lot of guts, her hometown of Clarksville wanted to honor her after winning those 3 gold medals. And she said she would only take part in a parade and a banquet if they integrated the events. That had never been done before in Clarksville. This is 1960, the heat of Jim Crow segregation, the early stages of the civil rights movement, and Wilma Rudolph helped pave the way both in civil rights and for women from those events in 1960.
It's funny, it reminds me of Nina Simone, who, as a child, basically integrated a concert hall. You know, sometimes young people seem to have had this moxie that people who were older didn't have. But how do you think people perceived the Olympic Games at that point? What was the significance? You know, now we have all this sports marketing, but in 1960, what was the significance of the Olympics?
Well, the essence of my book is that you could see the modern world coming into view in those Olympics. For better and worse. I mean, for better in the ways that it transformed both racial issues and gender issues, for worse in the sense that the first doping scandal occurred at those Olympics. A Danish cyclist died during a road race, and all of the issues involving doping emanated from that single event. Television then was not the saturation that it is now, nor was commercialism such. I mean, today the American Olympic basketball team is essentially the Nike team. You know, they spend millions of dollars on the shoes and the uniforms. In 1960, the team led by the great Oscar Robertson and Jerry West was truly amateur and all college players. So in many ways, the beginnings of what we see today was all happening in Rome in 1960.
You talk a lot about Cold War strategy and how that was, you know, kind of the invisible hand at these Olympics. Mm-hmm. With the Olympics we're having coming up with China in Beijing, there's also a lot of talk of geopolitics. How do you compare then and now?
Well, I think the Olympics have always been political. You know, the Olympic ideal is one of just individual athletes competing to the best of their abilities. But in fact, the Olympics are steeped in politics, whether it was 1936 when the Olympics were held in Nazi Germany and the great Jesse Owens sort of disabused the entire notion of Aryan superiority with his remarkable performance, or 1968 with Tommy Smith and John Carlos and the Black Power salute. So that's always there. Beijing, I think in the long run, no matter what happens on the athletic fields, whether the sprinter Gay sets a new world record or Phelps the swimmer wins 7 or 8 gold medals, it will be remembered for the politics and how the Chinese handled these Olympics and what they hope to be their century, the 21st century. In 1960, similarly, there were many wonderful athletes. We haven't even talked about Muhammad Ali, then Cassius Clay, who won a gold medal, Rayford Johnson, the best athlete of that era, the decathlete. But nonetheless, Rome was remembered for the politics of that moment, for what it meant in the Cold War and in the transformation of society. And I think China similarly will have that sort of resonance, for better or worse, depending on how the Chinese handle it in terms of human rights and how they deal with the world press and so many other issues.
David, it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay, Farai, great talking with you.
That was journalist David Marinus. His new book is called Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. He talked to us from the studios of Princeton University. Last time our contributor, Judge Lynn Toler, came on the show, she and NPR's Tony Cox talked about African-American fathers. The spark was Barack Obama's now famous Father's Day speech, and it prompted more than a few responses from listeners. It also got Judge Toler thinking about the issue of marriage in Black America, and she is here to share her thoughts. Hi, Judge.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
Oh, girl, you know, I spent 6 hours in one of my friend's house with 20 women just breaking it down.
I hear you.
I need to put that on fast forward and upload it to the internet, except we didn't record it. So, you know, Black folks have the lowest marriage rate of any group in America. You are host of the TV show Divorce Court. What have you learned, whether it's from your professional life, your life as an author, or your time as a TV host, about, you know, what makes a good marriage? Let's start with the positive.
What makes a good marriage is two people heading in the same direction with a good understanding of what it is to compromise. I think a lot of us, when we get married these days, are looking for happily ever after and not looking at marriage as a job in which you will not always be happy. I think one thing that has kept my husband and I together for 20 years is not only a commitment to be together and a commitment to our children, but an understanding that there will be lean times, there will be unhappiness, and we don't expect to be happy all the time. And I think once we, if you are willing to accept that, you know, marriage is such a good stabilizing factor, not only for the parties involved, the husband and wife, but for the children as well.
In the last census, only 36% of Black women were married. Now, of course, some of them may have been married in the past. It used to be 62% in 1950. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, the numbers of people getting married in America are dwindling. The number of single women are increasing for a couple of factors. Number one, when you had the feminist movement, it enabled women, you know, marriage was no longer necessary. Back in the 40s, and marriage was supposed to be what a woman did. Now that you are able to support yourself, that was an option. Women had more option, that number one. Then the sexual revolution, which said that marriage is no longer a moral imperative in order to have children. And that started happening. And people are living longer, so getting married is a proposition that's going to last 30, 40 years as opposed to a shorter period of time. So marriage in and of itself has to shift because the demographics, technology, everything has shifted, and the rights of women have shifted. So I think we are on the leading edge of that curve, but for a variety of reasons that have exacerbated the problem, I think, in our community.
Let's talk about the color line. As we as Black folks have moved out into the wider world, you know, when you talk about who do you meet on a daily basis, you meet more people of different races. And there are always issues, whether you date within your race or outside of your race. So what are some of the issues we should think about in terms of race and dating and marriage?
Well, first of all, I have to admit to, 'cause you always have to look at your emotional self before you answer any kind of question that touches this deeply. Back in college, I and my sisters had a problem with brothers dating white women. We had an issue with it. We had a problem with it. And I think a lot of sisters have a problem with it because mostly when you get interracial, it's Black men and white women. And you look at it as in a sense of sort of a rejection. Why not me? Why them? Now, statistically, that's a very small number, but it's generally been black men and white women. I think black women are more open to the idea these days, but I don't think the opportunity is there that much for us to marry outside of the race, because I think women are willing to make the hop to black quicker than white men are ready to make that hop to black. I don't know why I said that, but I think it.
Well, I think, you know, maybe it has something to do with, you know, where we are economically and how much we kind of travel outside the community, because I think of something like the movie Something New, where you had this whole portrayal of a black woman who had black suitors and a white suitor, ended up with the white guy, and her right. friends and family were flipping out. Maybe that happens more now, and maybe it is a time of change. But most black people marry or start families with black people. And so considering that, what do we do to make those families stronger?
What do we do to make those families stronger? That's a difficult question. I think it's a matter of, number one, understanding that this is the one big thing I always say, understanding that you will not always be happy. We live in an immediate gratification society, and if immediate gratification is what you're looking for, then you will not be in a long-term relationship. You won't be in a long-term marriage, because there are bad times, there are lean times. To make it stronger, you have to I'm a little old school on this one. And it has to be a return to making the right priorities. Your marriage, your wife, your husband, and your children being an appropriate and acknowledged priority, not just for the woman, but for the man as well.
So it sounds like you've got a one dash of sacrifice, one dash of enjoyment, or something like that?
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's difficult, especially when sisters, and often in the conversation it is said that, you know, you hear a lot about black women being narcissistic or black women being gold diggers. And when you talk to young brothers, they say that a lot. That conversation comes up, that happens. And then when you talk to black women who are accomplished, they say, I can't find a brother. I date outside my race because I can't find a brother willing to deal with me on my level. And everybody starts to become a little bit accusatory. You know, sisters are gold diggers. That's why they won't go out with a guy that's not a doctor as well. And, you know, brothers are you know,
right.
Had too many options.
Well, Judge Toler, you know what? This could go on for a lot longer, but we have to break off. I think we're going to have to pick this up. What do you think?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Lynn Toler is the star of Divorce Court and author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. And she joined us from radio station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How are you?
I am great. What are folks saying this week?
Well, we did a multimedia series this week called Road Trippin' that focused on how people are coping with ever-increasing gas prices. Steve Pye in Oakland, California, heard some of the stories and wrote us this. You had several segments on the so-called gas crisis. This is another self-inflicted problem on several levels. If you are crazy enough to buy a vehicle that gets poor gas mileage, shame on you, no matter what gas costs. What a foolish way to manage your money. Now suck it up and take responsibility for your bad decisions. Stop whining because I'm trying to enjoy my bicycle rides.
On a blogger's roundtable this week, we talked about actor Will Smith's interest in playing Barack Obama in a biopic. Kojo Jones in Atlanta, Georgia, was not okay with that suggestion. He wrote, Will Smith is Barack Obama? Heck no. Let's be clear, ears and popularity should not be the criteria for an acting role in a film about the Obamas. The actor who played White House Chief of Staff on the show Commander-in-Chief is the person to play Obama. Harry J. Lennox is his name.
Then for our Africa update, we interviewed the Zimbabwean ambassador to the United States for some perspective on the situation in the South African nation. Michael Zonta in San Francisco, California, wrote us this. You should be ashamed of interviewing straight-faced Zimbabwe's ambassador to the United States.
Well, Michael, this is what we do. We interview people. You use that information to decide if they're good or bad, telling the truth or lying. We followed the ambassador interview with our regular Africa update, which gave a very different perspective on Zimbabwe. On June 12th, we did a very in-depth interview with opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai before he dropped out of the runoff. We got the bases covered.
And finally today, Paul Pierlot in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, wrote in about a segment on how hip-hop websites were hacked by apparent hate groups.
He wrote, "I'm hearing a lot of reports of racists spewing their ugly noise. It saddens me, but please, please keep the faith. I want to encourage all our listeners of News and Notes to keep our eyes on the big picture. History is about to bust open like a field of wildflowers. I am surprised almost every day hearing another white workmate, friend, and even folks I pass in mall parking lots telling me they are also voting for Barack. Yes, we will have to absorb the sneers and insults of those with shriveled hearts and closed minds, but let us walk in the path of Jesus, Gandhi, and Martin. No, let us rather dance, for springtime is in sight."
And that's it for letters. Thank you for writing, and please keep your comments coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.